I call the House Education Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Falconer, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from March 10th? And if so, would you like to make a motion to approve them?
I have. They look great, so I move to approve them.
Great. Representative Falconer moves to approve the minutes from March 10th. Any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Well, welcome, everyone. Today we have three bills addressing a range of topics in education policy, and we are going to start out with a presentation from our state librarian, Tammy Lee, who will provide some context for our first bill of the day. Tammy, welcome. If you can make your way to the testifiers table, and when you're all settled in, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Tamara Lee, and I serve as the Minnesota State Librarian and Director of State Library Services and Expanded Learning Opportunities for the Minnesota Department of Education. I've been in my position since October of 2021. I've been asked to supply some data regarding the status of ebook lending and license fees in Minnesota. And so I'd like to start out with a little bit of background in that the figures in this presentation are pulled from the 2024 annual Minnesota Public Library Report. This is data that we collect every year in Minnesota through State Library Services, but it's in service to the National Public Library Survey that is required by the Institute of Museum and Library Services. And also, when I refer to circulating e-materials in the data, that includes electronic books, digital audiobooks, streaming video, and online magazines. I'm not sure if everyone has a handout. Graph one. This basically addresses regional totals for circulating e-materials by quantity, expenditure, and circulation. Minnesota has 12 regional systems, and the bulk of e-materials licensing is done by regional systems. Most public libraries in Minnesota provide circulating e-materials to their communities through their region. About 15% of public libraries license circulating e-materials for local use. And by that I mean not only do about 15% of libraries offer e-materials through their regional systems, but they also might have a separate local contract for a special collection or a type of service like Hoopla, that sort of thing. Graph number two. I'm so sorry. Libraries have been investing in physical collections for decades. So the biggest part of this, I mean, it looks like, you know, oh, we've got plenty of library materials. We've been investing in physical collections for years, and that means like books, paper books, CDs, DVDs. So the physical collection is still the largest one that is referenced in this graph. Excuse me, and still the most well-used part of any library collection in Minnesota. In 2024, electronic literacy materials accounted for between 10 and 32% of the collection in each region. And graph three, over the past 10 years, the demand for circulating e-materials, which we measure by usage, has increased about at the same rate across the state of Minnesota. In each region, libraries are spending more and more of their collections budget on circulating e-materials. And in summary, the 2024 data highlights both the growing demand for digital services and the operational challenges faced by libraries in meeting that demand. Thank you so much for letting me visit with you today, co-chairs, committee members, and Madam Chair. And for allowing State Library Services to present these findings.
Thank you, Tammy. Any questions for our State Librarian members? Otherwise, we'll move on to our library-related bill. Not seeing any. Representative Gottfried, if you could approach the table, get settled. And then it's our intention to move this to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. So, Representative Gottfried, when you're ready, would you like to make a motion to move House File 3698 before the committee to re-refer the bill to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee?
So moved, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Great. To your bill, Representative Gottfried.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Today, I'm speaking on behalf and for House File 3698. This is a bill that seeks to, you know, tackle a problem that we're seeing within our publicly funded libraries. And we use a definition of, you know, receives over half their funding from public funds, school libraries, libraries within the Minitex library network, and so on and so forth. And what we're seeing happening is that these public libraries are being overcharged, in essence, for these electronic literary materials. And I find that to be a not good use of public dollars. So as we are in a space where we're talking about appropriate use of public funds, we are trying to address this problem through contract law, wherein we are trying to prohibit public these public entities from entering into onerous contracts with private entities as well. And with that, I will turn it over to my expert here. We have Ms. Sarah Hawkins.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hawkins. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Awesome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Hawkins. I am the Assistant Director at Anoka County Library. I am also the Legislative Chair of the Minnesota Library Association, serving libraries statewide. So my goal today is to give a brief overview of the challenges we face when purchasing ebooks and to outline the legislative approach we are pursuing. Under current publisher licensing models, libraries pay significantly more for digital titles than for print, often several times more. These high prices come with restrictive contract terms that limit how libraries can purchase, use, and lend those ebooks. As costs rise, budgets are strained, and Minnesotans have reduced access to the digital materials they rely on. This issue has been unsustainable for over a decade, and it's a priority of the Minnesota Library Association across public, school, academic, and special libraries. Connecticut recently enacted legislation requiring more equitable ebook license terms for libraries. That law will only take effect once additional states representing 7 million people or more pass similar legislation. So House File 3698 is that comparable legislation we're considering, which aims to ensure fair and sustainable access to digital collections through contract law. So a bit of context. Public libraries generally lease ebooks and digital audiobooks through vendors, not directly from the publishers. And unlike our print books, ebooks are licensed, they're not owned, which means fewer rights and more restrictions for the libraries. We often pay 4 to 5 times the consumer price. Those licenses typically expire after 2 years or 26 checkouts, whichever comes first, forcing libraries to repurchase the same title repeatedly. Print works very differently. We own the physical item, and we usually don't need to replace it. Oftentimes, we don't look to replace it till 40 checkouts, 70 checkouts, or more. That often takes much longer than 2 years, sometimes 10 years or more. But the point is, it's that on our own terms when we choose to remove it from our collection based on our policies. So here's a specific example. Kristen Hannah's The Women, it's a super popular title. Consumer pricing is far lower than what libraries pay for both ebook and e-audio formats. Data from the Reader's First Publisher Price Watch shows that public libraries pay roughly 3 times more per copy than the digital retail market. The same study between 2022 and 2025, library ebook prices rose much faster than retail prices. For e-audio, library pricing increased 3.6%, while the retail market at the same time actually decreased 4%. Beyond pricing, several common licensing terms limit access. First, these ebooks generally cannot be loaned or shared between libraries, unlike physical materials, which means residents can only access what their local library can afford. Second, many vendors require non-disclosure agreements, which prevent libraries from discussing pricing or contracting terms, making it difficult to advocate for change and keeping libraries locked into inequitable practices. On the school library side, school libraries face additional challenges. Only licensed school librarians can complete ebook purchases, yet only 54% of Minnesota schools have a licensed media specialist. On top of that, the median school library budget is only about $5,000, an amount that doesn't go far given current ebook pricing, so those school libraries are relying heavily on their public library collections. These issues have real consequences. Access suffers when high prices and limits on sharing prevent libraries from offering robust digital collections. Schools that can't afford their own collections rely more heavily on public libraries, further stretching public library budgets. Accessibility is also affected. Digital formats are essential for patrons with visual or reading impairments. Without fair pricing and sustainable terms, libraries struggle to meet these needs. Finally, there's the issue of fiscal responsibility. Repeatedly leasing the same titles at high prices increases costs for taxpayers and prevents libraries from investing in the breadth and depth of their collection. For example, in the Twin Cities, our consortium has had nearly 14 million checkouts in 2025. We're the largest circulating digital consortium worldwide 5 years in a row. We spent $6.5 million, and yet we still had more than $21 million in unmet demand. We're not trying to spend less. We just want better value for the dollars we are already spending. So how do we address this? As I said, Connecticut offers a practical model. Rather than regulating publishers directly, rather than going after things that include violation of copyright law, the law focuses on contract terms that publicly funded libraries can agree to. It prevents agreements that restrict lending or interlibrary loan, limits artificial caps on how often or how long a digital item can be lent. It bans non-disclosure agreements, protects patron privacy, and ensures libraries have fair options when licenses expire. Overall, it promotes fair and reasonable terms aligned with the library's mission. House File 3698 is Minnesota's version of this similar legislation. It applies to, as Representative Gottfried said, it applies to public and K-12 school libraries that are publicly funded. And again, our intent is to protect taxpayer dollars, restore local control, and ensure Minnesotans have equitable access to their library collections through contract law. And I'd ask you to support House File 3698.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you.
My next testifier is Vivian Peterson, who is on Zoom. We are setting that up. After Ms. Peterson will be Todd Hill. So Todd, if you're in the room and want to approach and get ready. Do we have Ms. Peterson?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Jordan and committee members. My name is Vivian Peterson. I'm a sophomore at Hastings High School and a great enjoyer of what my library has to offer. I'm here to talk about something that has a true impact on students like myself, access to audiobooks through our school and public libraries. For many students, audiobooks aren't just entertainment, they are learning tools. I often use audiobooks from the library to help with homework, especially when I'm reading novels for English class. I find that following along with the text helps me grasp a deeper understanding of the story and the meaning behind the words. However, libraries have to pay extremely high prices for audiobooks through digital audiobook vendors. These vendors charge libraries far more than price individuals pay, and sometimes libraries even have to repurchase audiobooks after a certain number of checkouts. Because of these expenses, libraries can't always afford to offer enough copies of the books students need. Due to the size of my school library, we do not have access to audiobooks at school. As a result of this, students like myself have to wait weeks before we can access an audiobook from the public library for a story the class is assigned. By the time it becomes available, the class has already moved on, and we are left with a limited understanding of our material. Audiobooks also help people who may have dyslexia, those who struggle with reading, or students who simply learn better by hearing information. Libraries are one of the only places where anyone can access these resources for free, no matter their income. When audiobook vendors charge libraries at such high prices, it limits how many students can get the help they need. Lower prices would allow libraries to offer more titles and more copies, helping more students learn and keep up with their classes. Libraries exist to support education and equal access to information. Let's keep them that way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And last on my list is Todd Hill. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of American Publishers. I would draw your attention to the letter our client filed with the committee, along with one from the News Media Alliance in opposition to House File 3698. Before I start, I do want to thank the representative for meeting with us yesterday to discuss our concerns with this legislation. On behalf of hundreds of thousands of authors and creators in Minnesota and across the country, we oppose this legislation because it would significantly harm Minnesota readers, undermine the rights of authors and publishers, and threaten the availability of the viability of independent bookstores. Digital access has expanded how people read and listen to books. In addition to print books, publishers now offer the latest best-selling novels to libraries in digital formats that library patrons can borrow instantly without having to visit a physical location. More patrons than ever before have access to free publications at the push of a button. A record number of award-winning and best-selling literary works that they might otherwise have purchased from booksellers. Under federal copyright law, authors and publishers hold the exclusive rights to their creative works. These rights include the authority to decide whether, when, and how their works are reproduced, distributed, and licensed, including to libraries and other book markets like independent bookstores. This legislation attempts to take away the rights from authors, publishers, and other creators, and enables the government to make decisions about creators' intellectual property instead of the creators themselves. Libraries receive multi-user licenses from publishers that permit them to make ebooks available over and over again to their patrons at an aggregate cost that is far less than the per-reader personal use rates in the consumer market. I will just digress for a second and look at the chart that was provided today. If you look at The Women by Kristen Hanna, it does show that the cost of that book was $55 for the libraries and $15 for the individual market. But if you look at the 26 uses of that book, the actual cost comes down to $2.11 per license versus $15 for the individual. So they do get those licenses at a reduced price. This legislation will impact, or the likely impact of this legislation will be that it will reduce rather than expand access to the digital library materials in Minnesota. When publishers cannot meet the restrictive demands in this legislation, libraries may lose access to new releases, experience higher cost, or be prohibited by the state from licensing ebooks and audiobooks altogether. It is for these reasons the groups who stand in opposition to this legislation include, among others, numerous authors, creators, book publishers, the Authors Guild, the American Booksellers Association, and the News Media Alliance. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. With no more testifiers, we will move to member discussion, starting with Representative Falconer.
Hi, thanks. I'm sorry, I forget your name.
Todd Hill.
All right, Todd. Sorry. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I forgot that part of this whole thing. I'm just trying to figure out your comment of the ebook getting 26 uses versus only one. Mm-hmm. Consumer, I mean, I think to me the more applicable analogy to draw is how much a physical book is circulated within a library as well. You know, it gets more than just one use. And so I feel like you kind of made an unfair comparison of a library ebook getting 26 uses versus a consumer using it only once. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference? 26 uses is an ebook rented out. How many times is a printed book get used in a library?
Mr. Hill?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The challenge is that a paper book and an ebook are treated completely differently. the federal government has determined the regime, and it's a licensing regime for those e-books. And that is the way that the creators and the publishers then are able to manage those creations. And so trying to compare a book, a paper book to an e-book, it's just, they're not comparable. And what we have found is one of the big things that we've been able to do with e-licensing is allow new releases to be available the day they're available, the day they were released. If we were to follow this bill and allow the libraries to have multiple licenses with no limitations, what we have found is when we do that, it actually cannibalizes our sales at the rest of the marketplace. And so we have a very delicate balance here to manage the bookstores who are our customers, the libraries who are our customers, and the individual marketplace. And we have to maintain a balance there. And that is why this process has been set up the way that it is.
Representative Faulkner.
Okay. Sure, I can see that. I mean, that could be an argument to just end libraries altogether. And of which we're obviously not talking about, but that's kind of the reality from that sentiment. I just don't like the way you characterized your point of view here, that ebook in a library, 26 uses versus a personally owned library or book. So I still just take issue with that. And I don't know if I have anything else on that. Libraries exist so that people can have access to books as a public good with our tax dollars. I think that if we're charging for a book that's going to be used multiple times that a library is lending out and an ebook that gets used multiple times that a library is lending out, that they should be the same. Like, I'm just not seeing why there's a difference. If a person's reading a book, they're reading a book. A book to me would cost more to produce than an ebook, because once an ebook is in digital format, I mean, it's just like copy paste, within a license agreement, obviously. So, the existence of an ebook is cheaper than many physical books. I thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. It makes fairly common sense to me, especially in light of the misaligned example that you gave the committee.
Representative DePell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question about accessibility to e-books. We had quite a controversy in part of my district about books in libraries, and both in high school libraries, community libraries, and things of that nature, and children's access to different books that had sexually explicit content in it. There was a book called Gender Queer that had pornographic cartoon images of very sensitive sexual content as well. And my concern is with ebooks, the individual checks it out, but it's generally unknown to the parent that it exists because it's on a device. And it continues to be reviewed semi in secret. And though we're talking about how can we make these things less expensive and easier to access, my concern first would be, what is being accessed, and is there proper oversight with what's being accessed? Is it an item that is appropriate for that age group, or is it a bit of material that a parent wouldn't want their child to access? And then are we going to propagate more of that and make it easier for those children to do that, potentially in secret, without their parents' knowledge? And I think parents have made clear that they want to know and understand what's in the libraries and what these children are checking out in the libraries in my district, at least. And so I feel obligated to represent that perspective and see if those, if that book potentially specifically or another book like it that has sexually explicit content in it can be checked out by an individual as an ebook. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gottfried, would you like to answer that, or would perhaps Ms. Hawkins like to take that one?
Yeah, I think, and thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative DePell, for that. I think Sarah would be better to handle that. Yeah, appreciate it.
Great, Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that there are some distinctions, first, in between what a school library is offering and what a public library is offering, right? And that each library has their own collection development policy, what they are choosing to include in their collection or not include in their collection. But virtually every collection development policy that I have seen reiterates that the who chooses what a child is reading, that responsibility lies with the parents. It is the library's responsibility to provide the content. We provide content across all different viewpoints, all different areas, and that it is the parents' right and their responsibility to determine if that each individual title is right for their child to read or not read. I don't think it's necessarily any more burdensome in an ebook environment than it is in a print environment. If you are already, you know, choosing your monitoring access of your child's library card, any parent or legal guardian has the right to view what there is on their child's library card. And so I don't think necessarily there's any difference in distinguishing between print and digital in that sense.
Further questions, Representative DePell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a father of six kids, some of which frequent the library, one of which reads about a book a day and uses both a tablet or a Kindle and hard copies as well, you're absolutely correct that it is the parents' responsibility to monitor their children. However, we have certain safeguards in society about different things. It's very obvious that there are mischievous things that children do and find ways to do it. And I will say firsthand, it's a lot easier for an individual to do that on an electronic device than it is something that is out in the open that you can see. And so, again, I would just reiterate the question. Is that something that is in ebook form, and is that something that would be accessible to both children at libraries and the holistic portion of my question?
Ms. Hawkins.
Madam Chair, are you referring to the title specifically, genderqueer?
Representative DePell.
Madam Chair, thank you. That would be, yes, absolutely, specifically referencing that, or as I mentioned earlier, any other book title that has pornographic or sexually explicit content in it.
Ms. Hawkins.
Madam Chair, Representative, that title is available in digital format, correct? Libraries could choose to license that title for their collections.
Representative DePell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, that's all.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. I appreciate that. I agree with Representative DePell that too many libraries are pushing a lot of filth, and I'm totally on board with that. But I don't think this bill is going to change that. I see this as, you know, we're negotiating for better pricing. And normally I would be saying, well, let the free market work. But libraries aren't competing in the free market. They're primarily publicly funded, and that's really what the target of this bill is. And so we as taxpayers, I think negotiating for better pricing seems to make sense to me. And there's nothing forcing the publishers to enter into these contracts either. So that was a point kind of raised by the testifier that was concerning and that may limit their work. But, I mean, I see it as us negotiating for better pricing, and that's really all.
Thank you, Representative Gordon. Next on my list is Representative Lawrence.
Chair Jordan, thank you very much. Representative Godfrey, this is an interesting bill to bring forward. And a couple of questions for your testifiers. And just preface my comments is my wife, when my children were young, was very adamant to take them to the library. And they spent many hours at the library checking out books, looking and reading. And so I'm very grateful for that. We've got a great library in our local community as well. And so this is not opposed to libraries, but some more fundamental questions for more business focused on this aspect of it. So the first question I have is, are you required to enter into these contracts? Is there any statute that requires a library to offer ebooks, to enter in the contracts that we're talking about at this point in time? Sure.
Representative Gottfried, would you like me to ask Ms. Hawkins?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Great. Ms. Hawkins, help us out here.
Madam Chair, no, there is currently no statute that says that we are required to do so. It is the only way for us to get access currently is to enter into those contracts, and we do so at the demand of our community, of our patrons who are asking for that. It's a way to increase access. It's a way that if you look at the study, much of the reading is going these days more broadly. Audiobooks is one of the highest growing formats. So it is a way, in order for us to offer access that way, we do need to enter into these contracts in order to get our communities reading and increase literacy and ensure that we have a foothold in that.
Okay. Representative Lawrence.
Yep. Chair Jordan, follow-up question to that. So when you enter into a contract for an ebook, right, do you also purchase the hard copy? Do you typically have the hard copy on file in addition to the ebook in the library? Chair Jordan.
Ms. Hawkins.
Chair Representative, yes, we do. We typically are trying to, not always, but we typically are trying to purchase the titles in as many formats as we can to serve our community. Sometimes we need titles in large print. Sometimes we need them still in physical book on CD. Sometimes we don't. We are constantly studying the data of what our circulation trends are. We have forms that patrons can indicate their preferences for reading materials. But yes, it's typically, if we're purchasing it in digital, we're also purchasing it in print.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Jordan.
Representative Lawrence.
Follow-up question to that. So when you go, I go to the library and the hard copy's not there, I can check out the e-copy. How many times at the same moment in time could the e-copy be checked out by an individual or multiple individuals, I should say? The hard copy's one. The e-copy at one point in time, how many individuals could have that copy?
Ms. Hawkins.
Chair, Representative. It depends on how many licenses we're purchasing. The vast majority of the licenses are only available to us on a one copy, one user basis. So I'm buying a license, one license, then one person can have it. The next person can have it when that first person returns it. And then the next person can have it when that person returns it. That's the vast majority of what we buy. I think I have to check my stats, but it's something like 6% of the content that Anoka County purchased last year or licensed last year was available in a concurrent user model, meaning we buy a license that multiple individuals can have at the same time. That license still expires, mm-hmm. It was something like 6% of our content was available to us to even purchase in that concurrent user model in 2025.
Okay. Representative Lawrence.
Sure, Jordan. So the individual with the contract offered that opportunity. The license came with that opportunity that those in particular products could be offered on a vast, larger basis or concurrent basis, is what I'm understanding. It wasn't, I don't know if you requested as a library, but when you entered into the contract for that contract specifically said, this book in particular, we don't care how many individuals read it at the same time.
Ms. Hawkins.
Slightly, yes. The license is available as a concurrent users up to 100. So oh, okay. we bought that at, again, a significantly higher price than, and then that allows us to eliminate the wait period up to 100 people before we'd have to buy another license. But again, that the amount of content that currently is available to us in that license model is very, very, very minimal. Not enough at all to meet our demand.
Representative Lawrence, follow up.
Yep. Chair Jordan, thank you. And I thank you for sharing those facts and that background with it, because I think it speaks a lot to business and the marketplace being offered different products to make available as well. And so, I think of the authors that create the material. I mean, I think many of us spent time in college and had to go to the library and we had to buy books on top of it. And we didn't get to negotiate the price of those books, and they were fairly expensive. Anybody that had to do that, it was a huge expense. For most instructions, you maybe a quarter of the material in them on top of it. And so, I would rather negotiate better prices with all those authors for those books that I didn't know how necessary they would be in the classroom. I look at this the same way. An author has made a product that has become popular within our society. I think they still need to be compensated, and they should be part of that contract negotiation as far as what they think their product's worth. I appreciate the fact that you can have license that 100 people can use the same book at the same time. That's a great option. Those authors allow that, right? They say, you know what, we want more people just to read our material. We're not worried about the compensation in it. And then there's others that it's necessary for them. And so that's what I bring to the table. I understand the need of libraries. I appreciate the role that you serve within our schools and within our communities as well. But at the same time, people within our state that are writing material and content for whatever level of study on top of it, there needs to be that compensation back, and they should be part of that negotiation process, not us here at the state legislature setting the limit on what they might be compensated for the materials. Thank you, Chair Jordan.
Thank you. Last on my list is Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Jordan, and thank you. I had my libraries come in and bring this to me as well, and frankly, I was surprised at a lot of the things that they're sharing, just like you are, Ms. Hawkins, are sharing with us. And as a person who worked at the library to get myself through school, value them so much, so much. And as an English teacher, also want to say that I've sent my kids to the library multiple times. Everyone knew when Mrs. Mueller's class was coming to the library. I do want to just ask some questions because Representative Lawrence took one of my questions of how often, if you can have multiple people check out the same ebook at a time. That was a question, which is why I think that we got some of the pricing that you were talking about, Mr. Hill. Todd, sorry. Did I say? Sorry.
Mr. Hill.
You wouldn't be Mr. Hill now. So, in the letter that was provided, I did want to talk about at least a question about the response to some of the states that have tried to pass this, and it was deemed to be something that was an overextension of where it says Section 301 of copyright establishes a strong federal preemption with regard to any state bills that aim to limit or regulate exclusive rights reserved to copyright owners, and that this tried in Maryland, it tried in New York, and all of them were overturned or repealed or any of those things. What makes this bill different that would make that same outcome not the same?
Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, I think I can speak to it a little bit, but I can also hand it
would
over.
Would it be better to just have Ms. Hawkins take this? No, oh no. I apologize, Representative Gottfried.
Madam Chair.
I think it's always good to ask an expert. We have these wonderful testifiers, but if
Madam Chair, my understanding and Representative, my understanding is that we are using a different chapter of law to discuss this, but I will let the testifier and the expert speak a little bit more to that.
Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those laws that were overturned were laws that regulated the publishing industry that was based on the copyright claims. So instead of regulating the publishers themselves, this, again, is not going after copyright. This is regulating the libraries, and it is based on contract law. I will say Connecticut passed this law that has not yet been challenged in court, overturned. There are other states that are pursuing similar legislation like this as well.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you. I do have to admit that when I heard this idea, these were the questions that I had, because I was very concerned about, you know, as a person who has creative content myself, I know what it's like to not be compensated for those things. And so I do get concerned about, taking what maybe didn't work by controlling or, you know, looking at the publisher inside and then just saying, okay, fine, we're just going to go over here. We're gonna try to do it on the library side. That part concerns me. And so I call you Mr. Hill, but I know that's not your name. Todd. Oh, it is. Okay, good. I think I would ask the same question to you. Like, why were those actually put into this letter if these are completely separate laws, why was that something that was put into this letter? And what are the concerns that you're having with those?
Mr. Todd Hill.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. First, I will say that was a letter from the News Media Alliance, not from the publishers. So that is one of their arguments. I think with clearly with the other laws that were passed. Maryland passed a law. It was found unconstitutional. New York passed a law very similar to the Maryland law. The governor of New York vetoed the bill based on the litigation in Maryland. The fact of the matter is the Connecticut law has passed, but it has not gone into effect. So at this point, nobody's been harmed because the law is it doesn't kick in until 7 million people are covered by the law. So we would, I think one of the arguments we preserve to make is that this is just a backdoor way to do the exact same thing that the other laws did, and that is to regulate and impact the content creators' rights to their creations. And I just one other point I wanted to make. We were talking about the licenses that may be made available where there's 100 uses. Those are all decisions that are made by the content creator in coordination with the publisher, how they want their content to be made available. And but back to your question, I think you could make an argument that this is just a backdoor way to impact how creators control their creations.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And honestly, because you said that the Connecticut law hasn't gone into effect, we don't have any standing on it yet. We don't. I know it's been passed, but yet since it's not affecting anyone, there's no one also yet to contest it either. But your description of a backdoor way, honestly, that was my first thought. And so I do get a little concerned about this. I do worry about kind of finding this strange way to look at content creators and feel making sure that is not something that is going to that this isn't just that backdoor way of that. So at this point, I'm not comfortable with this bill, but I invite my members to vote their conscience at this point. Thank you.
Great. Seeing no more discussion, Representative Godfrey, closing remarks.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Speaker, and thank you, members, for this lively discussion today. Appreciate it. You know, a couple of things I will just say just to address some of the things that were said throughout. I think some of the questioning was, about ease of access of electronic content and things like that, and I think that's an entirely different discussion than what this particular bill is about. Nor do, as a person who creates content themselves, I also understand, the limits or setting limitations to that. But what I will say is that, this isn't an attempt to get at all content. It's not an attempt to get at all books or all ways of accessing literature. This is simply trying to get at electronic literature. And so I am very skeptical of the arguments that there would be any sort of market displacement that have been made here today. Those arguments, I do not find them to be to hold water, personally. We're in a situation right now where the public has very, very high demand for some of these electronic materials. And then we are also at the pressure point of contracts that are burdensome to our public institutions, our public libraries. And kind of caught in the middle of all that is the state government. So we have people demanding this thing. We have these contracts that are costing us a lot of money of public dollars, of taxpayer dollars. And this bill is an attempt to get that right, to make sure that we are providing the same content at a price that is fair to our taxpayers. And to say that we are trying to regulate content creators, I think, is also not a great argument, in that if you look at the language of the bill, starting lines 3.9 to the end, there is nothing in this bill that regulates price. There's nothing in there that regulates price. And so I think this is a good bill to prevent us from, as a state, from wasting money on contracts that are onerous to our public libraries. And so I would ask for a yes vote to refer this out of committee so that we can continue having this discussion and make sure that we are using taxpayer dollars well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, Representative Godfrey renews his motion to refer House File 3998 to the Elections Finance and Government Operations Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Gottfried, and I will now hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Hill while I prepare to present the next two bills.
Madam Chair, can I request a roll call?
Representative Pell, the bill has already had the, you have to request a roll call before the vote is taken.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. As you get set up up front, I'll start by announcing that our next bill for consideration is House File 3067. Members, it's our intention to hear this bill today and lay it over for future consideration. Chair Jordan, would you like to motion House File 3067 before us?
So moved. I move that House File 3067 to be laid over for further action at a later date. And I will also move the DE1 amendment. Would you like me to explain it, Mr. Chair?
I would, thank you.
Yeah, so members, bear with me today. This is kind of a wonky one. As to the amendment, there is a DE and it's much shorter than the bill. This is because many sections of this bill were passed into law last year. And we had hoped that that would be the end of the discussion on highly qualified paraprofessionals. Unfortunately, we have learned that the changes we made to keep paraprofessionals in the classroom apply only to special education paraprofessionals. The amendment today refers to the current law and also makes it clear that this legislation applies to all instructional paraprofessionals, both in Title I programs and in special education. So I ask for your support to get the bill in the shape that we should discuss it today.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Any discussion on the DE amendment? Seeing none, we'll be moving to adopt the DE amendment so that we can move forward. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Very good. It is passed. To the bill in total, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your time today. House File 3067 relates to legislation, as I said, to make sure instructional paraprofessionals, and I'm just going to say paras from now on, working with our students meet federal personnel requirements under No Child Left Behind and the Every Student Succeeds Act, as well as IDEA, Title I, and special education. So under all of these federal laws, special education paras must be considered highly qualified to serve students. And so this bill builds on steps taken in 2024 when MDE was directed to convene a working group to examine how to ensure paraprofessionals are highly qualified, which identified two pathways, a testing option and a professional development option. Legislation passed last year codifies these pathways and allows special education paraprofessionals to be deemed highly qualified through both routes. And this is, takes place in both writing and math. So this bill codifies that those exact same two pathways for Title I paras, either the test or professional development that is currently in place for special education paraprofessionals. So it treats all the paraprofessionals and allows them to become highly qualified in the same ways. So we don't have different options for special education versus all other paraprofessionals. This bill is important. It will keep approximately 4,800 paras working in our schools and meeting the needs of our students. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn this over to supporters of the legislation from the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, the St. Paul Federation of Educators, and SEIU 284.
Very good. I have on my list here in this order Dr. Alexis Mann, who's with the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. Second up will be Sa Lohr, who's a paraprofessional with the St. Paul Federation of Educators. Following Mr. Lohr, we will hear from Chris Stinson. If you want to head on up. Oh, our first testifier is on remotely. So whenever you're ready, please begin. State your name and begin, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Alexis Mann, and I am here representing the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education and New World Learning Solutions. And I'm here to express my support for House File 3067. This bill would ensure paraprofessionals who demonstrate a comprehensive set of 20 professional competencies are deemed to have met the formal assessment requirements under Minnesota law, giving districts a practical competency-based pathway to qualify paraprofessionals to provide Title I funded services. And I urge you to support this bill for three reasons. Reason one, this bill directly addresses Minnesota's paraprofessional staffing crisis. Minnesota districts are struggling to fill paraprofessional positions right now. Last year, St. Paul Public Schools alone had 155 paraprofessional vacancies, which is roughly 15% of its total paraprofessional workforce. And they held emergency hiring fairs for the first time in its history. Nearly 90% of Minnesota districts report being significantly impacted by the broader educator shortage, and paraprofessionals are at the center of that crisis. The current qualification barriers essentially screen out capable, experienced candidates who are ready and willing to do this work. And this bill creates a reasonable, as I said, competency-based alternative that maintains high standards while expanding the pool of qualified candidates districts can hire. The second reason is competency-based qualifications protect instructional quality while also removing unnecessary barriers. This bill does not lower the bar. It adds a rigorous alternative. It's not a shortcut, rather it's a meaningful skills-based measure of whether someone can do the job. The 20 competencies outlined in this legislation cover everything from understanding the roles and responsibilities of paraprofessionals to reinforcing reading, writing, and math instruction, and demonstrating a respect for student diversity using ethical practices for confidential communication. These competencies are all in line with the Council for Exceptional Children's nationally recognized core competencies for special education paraprofessionals. Districts would document and maintain evidence that each paraprofessional has demonstrated those competencies in their personnel file. The third and final reason is that because more qualified paraprofessionals mean better outcomes for our most vulnerable students. Research shows that when students have greater access to paraprofessionals, student achievement increases. The effects are even stronger in districts serving large numbers of students attending schools with high concentrations of poverty. Yet now, schools that fit this description more often than not have low paraprofessional to student ratios. When positions go unfilled, students who need additional support lose access to critical services, and they are subject to experiencing delays. This bill gives districts additional tools they can use to fill paraprofessional positions with competent people who are ready to serve students, ensuring that Title I dollars reach the children they are meant to support. And in closing, Madam Chair and committee members, this bill keeps the standard high. It gives districts a practical pathway to hire and maintain their staff workforce, and it puts students first. I respectfully urge you to pass House File 3067. Thank you, and I'll stay on for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Mann. Up next, we have Ms. Sa-Lor, and she is also joining us remotely. Please state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Sa-Lor. Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committees. My name is Sa-Lor. I'm here to speak in favor of the HF 3067, which would improve the way of Minnesota qualified paraprofessional position in the Title I and special education. I am a St. Paul resident and alumnus of St. Paul Public School. I have been working for early childhood, family education, bilingual, EA assistant for the St. Paul Public School since 1992. My role is to assist parents, education, home visit, Hmong translation, and early childhood programming. Unfortunately, my position was recently jeopardized and I almost lost my job only because the problematic guidance from the Minnesota Department of Education. In 2006, the federal government authored the credential requirement for paraprofessional working in the Title I settings. At that time, my colleague and I were told that in order to keep our job, we have to return to school to obtain an associate degree or pass a standard test or complete a really difficult portfolio process to show our qualification for the jobs. Because passing a standardized test is difficult for non-English staff, and we could not afford schooling. My faculty and I choose to compile a portfolio of our SPPS work experience to date. It was intense and high-consuming project. The portfolio qualified me for my position and should have secured my FPPS employment from any future inquiries. Last year, at the urging of the Minnesota Department of Education, SPPS Human Services contacted me and several other co-workers letting us know we no longer meet the qualification for my job. The job that I have been successfully serving for over 30 years. We are again told to earn an associate degree or pass either the para-pro or a para-educator test to stay employed.
Ms. Laura, if you could move to the conclusion of your remarks, please.
Okay. The professional or visual member of the community and occurring credential option to keep valuable and qualified personnel from applying for this important role. Bill HF3067 has been an option for Title I, paraprofessional and special education paraprofessional to meet the federal requirement by passing the captain criteria and opposed of a bias standard test administrator only in English. This is a much better gauge to determine whether someone is qualified to serve students in those important roles. Okay, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Laura. Up next, we have SEIU Policy Director Chris Stinson.
Thank you, Chair.
State your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Chair and members, my name is Chris Stinson. I'm the Policy Director for SEIU 284. We represent more than 10,000 education workers, including paraeducators across the state of Minnesota. The legislature created a working group to address the issue of highly qualified paras to respond to federal requirements. I provided staff support to SEIU's representative who wasn't able to join today. At the outset of the working group, we had strong agreement between labor and management, which was nice, I'll say. Strong agreement between labor and management that the feds got it wrong.
being good at taking standardized tests or having a degree does not make a para highly qualified. My political science degree, for instance, paras are not often asked to support instruction on U.S. Sino relations. Everyone has heard about racial bias in standardized tests, but I was shocked to learn that 87% of white paras pass the para protest, but only 65% of Hispanic and Asian test takers and only 48% of black test takers pass the para pro. The other test that Minnesota offers, the para educator, doesn't even collect race and ethnicity data, so we have no idea how biased that test is. I'll also point out that a recess para, a lunchroom para, someone who mostly assists with toileting, feeding, lifts, or a para who works in an elementary setting doesn't need to know how to calculate the area of a parallelogram by breaking it up into two equilateral triangles, which is just one of the questions on the para protest that I did not know the answer to. The feds do provide a third option to be considered highly qualified. States and local districts can create their own assessment. So the working group went to work designing a local assessment that would allow para educators to demonstrate the competencies that do make you a great para. The labor and management groups, again, pretty quickly agreed on what those competencies are. Things like the ability to reinforce a safe and healthy and effective teaching environment, understanding strategies for assisting with the inclusion of students in various settings, and the ability to use strategies that promote the students' independence. Together, as you heard, we came up with 20 competencies that we thought every para should have before their first student contact day. And I want to pause here and thank the legislature for your investments in the past in paid para training. Labor and management agree that the funding and that the time that this legislature already requires would be sufficient for paras to achieve those competencies. So good work to the legislature. The competency grid is being used and is working for special education paras across the state, but Title I paras are not allowed to use that competency grid. They're limited to the test or having an associate's degree, things that we all agree do not really make you a good para. The bill in front of you fixes that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stenson. Excuse me. Having no more testifiers, we'll now move on to committee discussion. Any discussion here, representatives? Ms. Bennett. Excuse me. Co-chair Bennett.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if we could have MDE just come up and comment on this. I'd like to hear their thoughts. And then I do have a question for whoever that is, too. I don't know if it's Mr. Ooney or there he comes. I know he's here because I followed him into this room.
And as you get set up, Mr. Ooney, please state your name for the record and begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, Chair, committee members, Chair. My name is Adele Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. Chair Bennett, could you repeat the question?
Co-Chair Bennett.
Sure. Just thank you very much. And I'm wondering if you just have some comments on the bill. And I do have a specific question about if you just have any thoughts on all what we've just heard. And...
Sure. Yeah. So I think some of the testifiers have kind of covered the history of the issue at hand, language that was passed last year, the work group to try to kind of figure out what were some alternative models to what was the prior requirements for highly qualified paraprofessionals, and trying to come in line with what was a viable model for the need in our districts, as well as trying to comply with federal law. I think we're still having some discussions between our teams in terms of what complies with federal law, but I mean, I think we're all in agreement that we want to make sure that we have the need for paraprofessionals in front of our students, but that we meet the highly qualified requirements, and we just want to make sure that we're in line with what the requirements are from the federal government.
Co-Chair Bennett.
Thank you very much. And also wondering, an additional question, why are Title I paras, why have them been treated differently than our special education paras? Just curious on that.
Mr. Ooney.
Yeah, that's a good question. I personally right now don't have the nuance between the definitional differences under our Code of Federal Regulations between the title programs and those serving special education or not in a title schools and those serving under just special education regulations. I'm happy to get that information from the teams just to provide that distinction. Unless someone else here has
that. Chair Bennett.
Thanks, Mr. Can Chair. Yeah, and also if
Go ahead. We can get that in, Mr. Chair, please. Madam Chair. chairs all around. I believe Justin Killian from Education Minnesota does have that legal distinction. If I mean, it's a really great question that I think we should get on the record, if that's okay.
Oh, and I'll also need him eventually. Yeah, sorry, but
Mr. Killian, when you're ready, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Bennett, thank you for your question. The way the federal regulations are written for Title I paraprofessionals versus special education paraprofessionals, if you were to look at them right now, if I were to put them in front of your face, they're pretty much identical, but they're under different sections of the federal code, and the way the federal USDOE manages Title I versus IDEA laws, and that's why they're in separate codes. Our State Department of Education has taken issue with the way the Title I regulations are written at the federal level to make the argument that they don't believe the competency rubric is actually an assessment. We have yet to get a definition from them about what assessment is. Our members use rubrics all day long to assess their students and to make sure their students are meeting state standards. We see a rubric as a perfectly acceptable assessment tool, and so we do not understand their interpretation and definition of assessment, but I can say that I think the reason MDE is treating them differently is because they are technically in different sections of the law at the federal level.
Follow up, Co-Chair Bennett.
Winnie, if I could. Hold on, just on or off. There we go. Sorry, Mr. Uni, to put you on the spot here, but just, you know, from MDE's perspective, then I'm trying to understand how would Title I professionals be treated the same way with these competencies, or are you required either at the state or federal level to handle them differently? How does that work, I guess, is my question.
I think I got a little clarification, and, you know, I got a little clarification from our expert staff. I'm not as familiar with the nuances of the difference between the laws, Mr. Killian here, or our staff, so I'm happy to follow up with those. But the broad general understanding is that under the special education federal regulations, we have a little bit more latitude than what's explicitly laid out under the title statutes for what is required for these. So there are some differences here, and, you know, based on some of the testimony reflected here today, I'm sure there's some clarification that we can provide for the committee, but I just don't have all the clarifications at it.
Thank you.
Further follow-up, Ms.?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't ask any more follow-up, so I appreciate that information coming. And, you know, when I was teaching many years, I worked with both Title I and special ed paras, and we never really had a big distinction between them, so I'm curious how that works now. So thank you for that.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That info.
Any further discussion from the panel? Vice Chair Mueller. One quick comment from Mr. Stinson.
I apologize. There was some conversation about this as part of the working group that I think might be helpful too. The federal law requires that Title I paras meet, quote, a rigorous standard of quality and can demonstrate through a formal state or local academic assessment knowledge of the ability to assist in instructing as appropriate, right? The statutory language is really about reading, writing, and math. So those are the next three words, like reading, writing, and math. And the READ Act training, which I know some folks here are quite familiar with, far exceeds the requirements of the federal law. And so what we're kind of looking for from the department is just a similar set of training modules that meet or exceed the federal requirement for writing and math so that we can be sure that this competency grid is meeting those federal requirements.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I pulled up the list of the competency assessment thing, both from from MDE and from EdMIN. One from EdMIN you can just fill out electronically, which I appreciate. Thank you very much. But when I was looking it up, my question is this. When the working group was talking about using competence-based, and I'm all for looking at competency based. Like, I have been a proponent of this for a long, long, long time. What I'm asking is how are districts being trained to decide what is meets or does not meet? That's kind of what I just wanted to know. Because some of these things, when I was looking at the list, it's not like some of these are things that obviously as a teacher, you can look at it and be like, okay, that makes sense. But some of them are not. And so I just wanted to know how some of these more abstract ones, how they're being assessed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Jordan, do you want to handle this one or one of your guests?
I would say perhaps Mr. Stinson would be a great person to jump in.
Fantastic. Mr. Stinson.
Yeah, each one of these competencies was kind of pulled out of the a grid that was created by Pelsby to consider someone highly qualified. And so you'll see that on at least some versions of the grid, the numbers don't make a ton of sense. It goes from 5.3 to 5, or 5.1 to 5.3, for instance. That's because in the other grid, there's a 2, right, in between. But we didn't think that you needed to have that competency before your first student contact day. The thought was that some of the other competencies were more for very advanced paras with multiple years of experience to demonstrate in order to get kind of like a higher rate of pay or something like that. But so you can look at the Pelsby grid that will have a little bit more guidance about what each one of these things means. And the districts have access to that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And okay, that's more helpful to see. We'll definitely go look at the Pelsby because I'm sure they offered a lot of guidance for our districts for that, which is fantastic. Just one correction with that, because you're right with that some of our paras are going through REDAC training, but only the paras that are working with foundational literacy skills are doing that. So not all of our paras are going through REDAC training. Hopefully in the future they will be, but as of right now they are not. So I'm glad this is being laid over so that we can have, that we can continue to think about this and look at this, but been a huge proponent of competency-based things, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Any further discussion? Seeing none. Closing comments, Chair Jordan.
Yeah, I just want to take a second to really thank all of our paras in our schools. You know, these are often the very first face our students see when they walk in the door and the last they see when they go home at night. And so they feed our students, they drive them to school, they help them with some of the most basic tasks, but also some of the most complex tasks they do as students. They help children with special needs. They help children succeed and become the workforce that we all want them to be. And often these are the lowest paid workers in our schools, despite the tasks that we ask them to do. And so I think we should keep them in the classroom, keep them in the buses, keep them in the lunchrooms. And I hope this bill is one that can do that. Looking forward to the discussion. And with that, I renew my motion to lay over House File 3067 as amended for consideration at a later date.
And with that, we will lay over House File 3067. Our last bill for the day is House File 3730. Members, it's our intention to hear the bill and lay it over for further future consideration. Chair Jordan, would you like to move that bill before the committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Now that it's before us, I understand that you have an author's amendment that you'd like to get the bill in the shape you prefer. Would you like to motion the A1 amendment before us?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. To the A1 amendment, Chair Jordan, or if you prefer, we have some testifiers, maybe to Megan Arriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am happy to address the amendment. These are largely technical changes to clean up the bill into the form that we would like it, and I will call out in my remarks as we walk through what areas have been amended by the amendment.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Briefly.
Apologies. For the record, my name is Megan Arriola, Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education.
I'd like to move to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. We have adopted the amendment. Do we have any discussion or comment before the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is the MDE policy bill for this year. We have testifiers and MDE experts, so I'll just let them take it away. Thank you.
Wonderful. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair. My name is Maren Halden, and I serve as the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you so much for this opportunity to make some very brief remarks on MDE's education policy bill before us, House File 3730. I want to thank you, Chair Jordan, for agreeing to author the bill, and thank you, Chair Bennett, for meeting with our team last month to walk through the bill. The policy before us bill includes a range of provisions aimed at continuing to ensure that our students learn in safe and supportive learning environments and that local education agencies have the clarity that they need to best support our students. Many of the provisions are detailed or technical, yet important changes. So I'll just briefly address a few sections that we would like to highlight for the committee. MDE is asking the legislature here to put into state law the federal protections that already exist for our migratory students and for students who are homeless or highly mobile under the McKinney-Vento Act. We know that these students and their families often face disruption and instability in many areas of their lives, and so placing these existing federal educational rights into state statute helps make clear that these students have the right to consistent, stable access to their education. You will also see updates to the student bullying law that align with the guidance MDE has been sharing with schools and districts in recent years about how to respond to the student who engaged in the bullying. Schools already have really clear responsibilities in law to support the students who was targeted and impacted, but best practices in violence prevention show that if we don't also address the underlying reasons for the acting student's behavior, we won't see the long-term reductions in bullying and increased student safety. This bill would also require school safety plans to spell out how the school responds to both the target and the actor in the bullying, in any given bullying incident. Districts would have until the 2027 to 2028 school year to update their safety plans to reflect this. You'll also see in this bill some language clarifying the active shooter and lockdown drill requirements that were passed in 2023. As we've implemented the updated definition of active shooter drill, MDE has received a number of questions from the field, things like about which drills fall under each category and when students must be present or not, and whether existing trainings meet the definitions. So the changes in this bill reflect the guidance that we've been providing over the past 2 years. The goal here is not to change the intent of the 2023 bill, but simply to clear up areas where schools have been experiencing confusion and to provide that clarity. Finally, the largest article of the bill builds on the last several years of legislation to increase accountability and transparency for our charter schools. So I will now turn over to my colleague, Megan Mazzariola, to provide a section-by-section walkthrough of the bill. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll both be here for questions following her presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As Ms. Holden stated for the record, my name is Megan Ariola, the Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education. I'll be giving a walkthrough of each section of the policy bill, and since the bill is short and I know that we are at the end of committee time, I will be happy to stick around for questions at the end of the presentation. Beginning with Article 1, Section 1 on line 1.18, this amends the statutory definition of kindergarten to make it clear that kindergarten is a grade and not a program. It also includes language that mirrors the changes to school readiness we will be making in Section 5 as well. Article 1, Section 2, beginning on line 2.1, codifies in state law existing protections for homeless and highly mobile students currently provided in the McKinney-Vento Act. The language in the bill is not intended to add existing effort and services that schools currently provide these students, rather to give consistency between state and federal law to reduce any possibility of disruption to these vulnerable students' access or education. Article 1, Section 3, beginning on line 3.30, provides a similar codification in state law for existing protections for migratory students that exist federally. Article 1, Section 4 makes one line change on line 5.2 to be clear in state statute that academic standards are adopted for the K-12 system as a whole. Grade level appropriateness is determined and established in the grade level benchmarks, as you heard in our presentation to this committee last week. Article 1, Section 5, beginning on line 5.5, amends the Comprehensive Achievement and Civic Readiness Statute to remove a reference to meet school readiness goals and replaces it with more holistic language that you see on line 5.15. The field has previously told MDE that the term school readiness is alienating to certain communities and families, and this language was created in conversation with community partners to reflect the responsibility of adults and systems to support all learners. Article 1, Section 6, beginning on line 6.4, creates a new section of law under the Safe and Supportive Schools Act that clarifies the ways schools should respond to bullying instances that support both the target of the bullying behavior and also addresses the cause of the bullying behavior from the actor. This is aligned with best practice in violence prevention as in the violence prevention field as a whole and makes explicit in law the practices MDE guidance has encouraged districts to author. This section was amended by the author's amendment to include intermediate schools and tribally controlled schools who are also able to access safe and supportive schools funding. Article 1, Section 7, beginning on line 7.1, amends the definitions under the school safety drills law to more clearly delineate between fire drills, lockdown drills, shelter-in-place drills, and active shooter drills. These changes and the changes in Section 8 are responding to inquiries from the field about how to best implement the changes around active shooter and lockdown drills passed in 2023. Article 1, Section 8, beginning on line 8.23, adds a subdivision to the school safety drills law that requires districts to adopt statewide guidance, which MDE will provide and make available, and lays out the ways that each school will differentiate between lockdown and active shooter drills. This establishes standard practices around frequency of each drill type and permits districts to continue to use their discretion in offering certain drills with or without students present in efforts to reduce trauma for students but encourage adult preparedness. Article 1, Section 9, beginning on line 9.14, requires that expulsion hearing transcripts be made available to all parties upon appeal of the decision and that these complete hearing transcripts must also include a written transcript. This change is meant to address a problem of inconsistency in quality of audio-visual hearing transcripts provided to appealing families and meets the interpretation of a ruling from the Minnesota Court of Appeals on this issue. Article 1, Section 10, beginning on line 10.10, makes two changes to the application criteria MDE sets for new applicants to the Federal Child and Adult Care Food Program or the Federal Summer Food Service Program. One change on line 11.21 clarifies that sponsoring organizations' maximum growth increase limitations are capped at 25% growth per program, not for the sponsor's financial portfolio as a whole. The second change on lines 11.27 and 11.28 strike a reference to Chapter 13D as binding for board meetings for sponsors. Chapter 13D has limited scope over only public organizations and nonprofit sponsors are not, so this requirement should be removed because it is incorrect. Article 1, Section 11, beginning on line 12.10, and Article 1, Section 12, beginning on line 12.15, make changes to the legislation passed last year, allowing for students to purchase a second breakfast or lunch if they've already received one meal at no cost under the Minnesota Free School Meals Program. When this law passed last year, MDE received immediate feedback from our school nutrition program officers in the field asking for clarity about how they most appropriately implement this law, particularly when it comes to billing and accounting for these additional purposes and questions about the practical application for schools that don't have kitchens or other food prep areas in their building. These changes here are meant to clarify that a student may purchase a second entree for breakfast or lunch at the non-program price, and that a school may sell the student that entree if the school has one available. Students have always had the ability to purchase additional a la carte items under Minnesota Free School Meals, and these changes do not alter that ability. Article 1, Section 13, beginning on line 12.21, establishes in state law a deadline for the Summer Food Service Program new applicants of May 1st. Under federal law, states have the ability to establish their own deadlines for these applications, and May 1 is the deadline that MDE has been using for years and have never had an issue with an applicant being able to meet that deadline, so we would like to add that to statute for consistency. Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 1. Article 2, Education Excellence, Article 2, Section 1, beginning on line 12.28, provides MDE the authority to establish alternative assessment options for bilingual SEALs for languages that do not have a nationally normed assessment available. Under existing law, students must demonstrate proficiency through commercially available, nationally aligned assessments in all four language modalities in order to receive their bilingual SEAL. However, of all of the languages spoken by Minnesota's multilingual learners, only 10% have national assessments available. Allowing MDE to provide alternative assessment options will allow students to demonstrate the mastery of their language and create a more inclusive and equitable system that recognizes the full linguistic diversity of our state and our student population.
Article 2, Section 2, beginning on line 15.6, is the first of three READ Act provisions in this bill. This section provides consistency in the ability of parents to opt out of individual literacy screeners for students in grades K-3 as they are currently able to do for students in grades 4 through 12. The only remaining difference here is that for students in grades K-3, an opt-out may only be allowed if the student's teacher agrees that the screener in question may not be appropriate for that individual student's needs. Because the students in these grades K-3 are the most critical to support their literacy attainment, these opt-outs would be allowed only in limited circumstance and would not remove other obligations for the student and the teacher to continue to provide literacy interventions between screeners. This section was altered by the amendment to strike the language on lines 15.9, beginning with the screening tool, through line 15.23, ending in reading skills. This section was stricken because those requirements are already provided for in existing law that you'll see on lines 15.8 through 15.17. So we are striking this so as not to be needlessly duplicative in the same section of law. Article 2, Section 3, beginning on line 17.5, amends the parent notification section of the READ Act to affirm the requirement that when students in grades 4 through 12 are screened once per year who are not reading at grade level, their parents have to be notified that a screener took place in the same way that they're notified for students in grades K through 3. And this section was altered by the amendment as well to relocate the new language that currently appears on line 17.19 through 17.21 to be added to line 17.10 after the word year. Article 2, Section 4, beginning on line 18.3, establishes new requirements for MDE to review READ Act curricula and intervention materials on a regular basis to keep our list of aligned materials up to date. This section was also altered by the amendment to change the date for the department to establish this review process by October 1st of this year instead of June 1st. And this amendment also struck the language from line 18.18 that says, "and an institution of higher education, our ability to partner with an institution if we desire is already made available in other sections of law." Article 2, Section 5, beginning on line 18.26, amends PSEO law to consistently refer to the post-secondary institutions participating in PSEO as eligible institutions, and this just aligns better with terminology in other areas of PSEO law. This section states that the requirements of this chapter are also the basis by which a student may be denied participation in a PSEO course, and that failing to meet these is the only method by which you may deny a student participation in a PSEO. Excuse me. This section also strikes language on lines 19.16 and lines 19.7, as that language already appears in lines 19.5 through 19.11, and this is a duplicative reference. Article 2, Section 6, beginning on line 19.18, amends a provision of law passed last year that establishes a secondary date by which a student may notify their school that they plan to participate in a PSEO course. The language in current law was stricken and rewritten to make it clear that the May 30th notification deadline may be given for both terms of the following school year, and that if a student does not participate in the PSEO course in the fall of their school year, they may notify their school by October 30th of their intent to participate in a spring term PSEO course. Article 2, Section 7, beginning on line 20.3, amends the secondary course credit law to make it clear that PSEO course credit may be granted to satisfy graduation requirements so long as there is demonstrated alignment between the standards and the student's alignment under the course. This section also establishes a process by which a school district may request additional information about the course offerings from the eligible institution to determine if that alignment is met. And this would also grant MDE the ability to be the final decision if there's a disagreement about course and credit eligibility, and that our decision would be binding. We currently do provide this mediation, but giving us the last say kind of removes the problem for the family of the student and the district. And Article 2, Section 8 repealer is repealing the existing process for MDE to review curricula. Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 2. Article 3, charter schools. These are largely technical changes that I am going to speed up a little bit to just make it through, but happy to answer questions on any of these ones. Article 3, Section 1 makes it clear that charter schools that serve preschoolers and kindergartens have to abide by the screen time limitations for early grades. Article 3, Section 2 amends the statute on corrective action to make technical changes about the term chartering.
and to make it clear that additional business days, or to add additional business days to make time for the commissioner to determine their final notice about placing an authorizer in corrective action without making them wait for too long. Article 3, Section 3 amends the publishing requirements passed last year for authorizer. This is largely to eliminate duplicative language in statute. Article 3, Section 4, beginning on line 24.19, amends the statute around the charter school initial board of directors. And Article 3, Section 5 amends the compensation cap language that was established last year for ongoing charter school board members. Article 3, Section 6 relocates a chapter of authorizer law to a more appropriate home. Article 3, Section 7 is also a relocation provision, and Article 3, Section 8 is another relocation and statute provision. Article 3, Section 9 sets minimum expectations and requirements for charter school board meeting minutes. And Article 3, Section 10 cleans up the statute on charter school and school board, school district collaboration agreements. Article 3, Section 11 also strikes duplicative language and publication requirements for authorizers. Article 3, Section 12 strikes language from a location in statute where it is not appropriately housed, and relocates it to another section of charter statute 124E. Article 3, Section 13 amends the CMO and EMO accounting provisions, and then Article 3, Section 14 is a repealer that repeals the existing section of charter school law that is now reflected in Section 11, and so it takes it out of its inappropriate statutory home. And finally, Article 4, the changes in this article are meant to reconcile the currently piecemeal statutory approach to procurement in state statute for school districts. And I do want to note that we're in conversation with our school partners to work on incorporating some of their feedback about how to make this statute work better. In the end, it is mostly about trying to create a singular home for all of the expectations for procurement and purchases using state dollars from school districts to make sure that it is not overly burdensome for districts to be following their obligations under the law for that. Mr. Chair, that brings us to the end of my presentation, and I stand ready for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Garrity Gerber. I am the business manager for Holdingford Public School and the vice chair of the legislative committee for MASBO. I'm here today to express my concerns over Article 4 of House File 3730, specifically the scope of the policy, the breadth of the conflict of interest provisions, and the proposed limitation on contract length. First, the bill states all purchases must comply with the procurement policy. There is no minimum threshold. Second, while not opposed to conflict of interest provisions, the bill establishes a very broad provision that extends to all employees and references their partners, family members, companies that currently employ or will employ one of these persons in the future, further requiring proactive disclosure of any potential conflicts. This language mirrors uniform grant guidance. When paired with the all purchases language, this level of scrutiny does not make sense applied to routine purchases. Districts do not have the practical ability to monitor or verify the personal relationships or potential future employment connections referenced in the bill. In practice, this means that districts would either need to rely entirely on self-disclosure or assume significant compliant risk. Both come with cost to districts. Last, the policy language restricts contracts to 2 years with a two-year renewal. This severely limits the ability to operate efficiently with fiscal responsibility and within other statutes. For example, curriculum is typically a 4 to 6 year contract in order to save money, but also for consistency and reducing the need for professional development required when searching curricula. My district has a 5-year internet agreement through the federal E-Rate program. Our on-site solar electricity has a power purchase agreement of 15 years. State law allows us for group insurance contract for up to 5 years. My next bus will be purchased using a state contract of 4 years with an 11-month extension, and many co-op and state contracts extend beyond the 2+2 threshold.
Mr. Gerber, if you could move to the conclusion of your remarks, please.
MASBO met with MDE last week to discuss these terms, and we appreciate their willingness to listen. In that conversation, we encourage MDE to work within Minnesota's existing procurement statutes, which provide strong safeguards while allowing districts to operate efficiently. I respectfully ask the committee to carefully consider the impact of this language. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I hope that these concerns will be addressed moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Up next, we have Mr. Kaufman. If you could keep it to 2 minutes, please.
Absolutely.
Apologies.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you again for allowing me to speak. I'm Rick Kaufman, Executive Director of Community Relations and Emergency Management for Bloomington Schools, 30-plus years working with schools on school safety. I want to speak directly to Section 8, Subdivision 1A, Line 8.25 on the school safety drills. I think it's on page 8. I appreciate the direction of this legislation as a whole. However, the language in Subdivision 1A reflects an older model of school drills that focuses on practicing specific incident types such as fire drills, lockdown drills, or active shooter drills. Today, most school systems across the country and in Minnesota train very differently. More than 40,000 schools nationwide now use the Standard Response Protocol, otherwise known as SRP, created by the I Love You Guys Foundation. In Minnesota, a quick review of the major metro districts shows that roughly 4 out of 5 of our largest school systems have adopted SRP. Since outstate and smaller districts follow their regional training partners, it is estimated that more than 60% of Minnesota students are in districts using the SRP or a similar framework. Standard Response Protocols focuses on practicing protective actions, evacuate, secure, lockdown, shelter, hold, rather than drilling for specific scenarios. This approach is supported by brain science and evidence-based safety practices because it simplifies decision-making during high-stress, acute stress response situations. Staff and students learn a small number of consistent actions that can apply to virtually any emergency. For that reason, the legislation should avoid prescribing specifically narrow lists of drill types. Instead, we recommend language that maintains Minnesota's current expectation for 11 or fewer regular drills each year, but allows districts to conduct those drills using protective actions within modern emergency response frameworks, including evacuation, secure, lockdown, shelter, and hold. This approach maintains accountability, aligns with how schools are already training, and allows districts to implement nationally recognized safety frameworks like Standard Response Protocols. Ultimately, this is not about changing the intent of the bill. It is about ensuring that Minnesota statute reflects how schools actually prepare today for emergency of any kind. With a small adjustment to the language, this legislation can both strengthen school safety, align current law with modern evidence-based practices already being used in schools across this country.
Mr. Kaufman, we need you
Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Up next, we have Caitlin Schneider from Education Minnesota, followed by Mr. Matt Shaver from Ed Allies.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chairs, my name is Caitlin Snyder with Education Minnesota. I have a flag mostly about a timing issue more so than a substance issue. Members who serve on Education Finance heard Representative Bigberg talk yesterday about the Blue Ribbon Commission and the conversations they're having about how to meet their target of cutting $250 million. He talked about ADSIS. Another item that has been identified by MDE to potentially cut is homelessness transportation in the special education formula. That can be cut from the special education formula under federal rules without interfering with the maintenance of effort, because it's not technically a special education fund, and it just happens to be about the same price tag as what they're shooting for. I have timing concerns about Article 1, Section 2 that relates to making sure that our students that are facing housing insecurity get the services that they need, because of the conversation that's happening right now in the Blue Ribbon Commission about potentially cutting those services and the funding that goes to districts for those services. This really impacts regional centers, so not just Minneapolis, St. Paul, but Duluth, Moorhead, Winona. If you represent an area that has more infrastructure to support people facing homelessness and housing, this will hit you disproportionately. So I would much rather have this conversation after we have successfully prevented the Blue Ribbon Commission from making cuts of special education. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schneider. Up next, Mr. Schaefer. Then we have three on the list, and then we will offer an opportunity for the co-chairs to comment before we lay this bill over and head off to our next session. Mr. Schaefer.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Matt Schaefer, Senior Policy Director at Allies. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on the MD policy bill. HF 3730 is amended. Thank you to Rep. Jordan for carrying it. I'm going to focus our comments with our concerns for the proposal in Article 2, Section 7, lines 21.6 through 21.20, which would create a process for high schools to dispute the alignment of college coursework to state high school standards. The department's proposal burdens students rather than the institutions involved to demonstrate the education the student received was rigorous and aligned to graduation standards. It requires students, not professors or the college, to submit a syllabus and undefined, quote, other materials necessary to a high school to demonstrate whether the college course they successfully completed met or exceeded those state high school standards. The notion that in order to stay on track for graduation, a high school student would be expected to navigate a dispute between a college and a high school and potentially the Department of Education over whether or not a college course they took and passed is aligned to K-12 standards doesn't provide students a meaningful voice, setting them up to be run over by bureaucracy. Students shouldn't get caught in the middle of systems-level conversations about high school and post-secondary course alignment that in reality has more to do with how the state splits money between the institution and high school than whether or not college courses are aligned with state standards. This really matters. And according to MD's 2026 rigorous coursework report to the legislature, PSEO is the rare education program we have in Minnesota where we've actually closed an opportunity gap. There's near racial parity in access to PSEO statewide and an actual closing of an opportunity gap for black students specifically. 37% of high schoolers in Minnesota are students of color. 35% of PSEO students are students of color. 11% of high schools schoolers are black, while 15% of all PSEO students are black. PSEO demonstrates exactly the kind of fair access to opportunity rigorous coursework should be providing. It's the only type of rigorous coursework with this data we have. So if the funding mechanism is flawed and outdated, let's fix the funding mechanism. Don't create another barrier to access for students and stall out that all-too-rare good news we have. There's bipartisan efforts moving in the other body to create that dual enrollment task force, which we support. We have strong concerns about this kind of proposal, which would kneecap the real progress we have here. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you all for your public service to our state.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. We have just a few moments left here for testimony. We'll start with Representative Keeler, followed by Representative DePell.
I don't have testimony, I just have a question. Well, I have a couple questions. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Jordan. I guess my first question is around the homelessness stuff. I just want to remind us that in the work that we've done around the attendance task force, transportation was one of the buckets that we actually identified in what some of the barriers were for our students to be successful. If I can ask nonpartisan staff for just a clarification. So I'm looking at line 3.5, 3.6, and it refers to an underlined statute subdivision around transportation. I know that in 310 and 311, we talk about, or down 315, we talk about supports for an academic year. Can you just clarify for me that the transportation language with the underlying statute means that we would provide transportation for a student experience unsheltered living for the remainder of their school year?
Mr. Strom.
I'm sorry about that. Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, the transportation provisions for the homeless are part of Section 123B92, and that essentially requires, that matches the McKinney-Vento and requires the districts to transport. That's part, as was mentioned, as part of our special education funding formula. And that transportation is depending on the districts, which of the special ed formulas the district is under is either included in that formula or not. So there's a separate line item for that now. And that transportation is essentially covered and funded through that item. So the reference here on line 3.6 to 128.20 sub D2 isn't really the one for the funding. That's in chapter 123B.
Representative Keeler, any quick follow-up?
Yeah. maybe I need to ask my question different. I think what I'm trying to get to is if a student has experienced unsheltered living and they need transportation to get to their school of origin, are we going to be able to cover that transportation for the remainder of their school year, not just the remainder of an like a semester?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, yes. Under the transportation provision, that's required for the rest of the school year.
Okay.
Yep.
I just wanted to make sure that was on the record. The next question I have, thank you. The next question I have, I actually am really interested in the SRP conversation that we were having because I do think to be really prescriptive about what's happening in the world right now and what our kids need to get used to is creating a really big mental health ripple effect for our kids. Just sending kids through some of these drills can just be really overwhelming. So I think it would be worth our time to maybe explore what that could look like a little bit more. The last thing is more of a suggestion, but also an understanding of why we're not using the same language in some places of this bill and we're not in others. It may just be able to be an oral amendment. So on 15.27, 15.28, we just say a parent in consultation with a teacher. But when we move to 24.3 and in other places, we say parent or legal guardian. And I think it is really important that we don't just say a parent because we know many students have different family styles. And so maybe that's just oversight, or is there a reason why in this section it's only identifying a parent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I appreciate the flag. I don't believe there's a reason except that we were trying to be consistent within the READ Act. I do think that your point about other areas in Chapter 120 using the reference of parent or legal guardian is a good one that I'm happy to discuss more. I think it's, you know, that's a pretty tactical fix if that's how we refer to parents or legal guardians in the rest of education statute. So.
Rep. Keeler, further follow-up, we do need to move. We are going to go about another 9 minutes before we gavel out and lay this bill over. So please quickly, and we will move on to the other.
I think that's fine. I think I would just like it to be consistent mm-hmm. across the board. That's all that I'm asking. Thank you.
For sure.
Up next on our list is Representative DePell.
Thank you, Chair Hill. A couple questions, just two, and I'm going to try to be real quick. Mm-hmm. First, about sports, is there any conformity to federal requirements to make sure that biological males aren't competing against biological girls? And then second, I was reading through some of the language here about bullying, and I wanted to make sure that there are many individuals who have deeply held religious beliefs and biological and reality beliefs about gender, and most importantly, that biological males are scientifically that, and biological girls are scientifically that. And so if they held to that belief in reality, would that be considered bullying as well?
Ms. Arriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative DePell, there are no changes in this bill that would amend any of the laws around school sports. For the question about a specific instance of bullying, that would be addressed, and a district's ability to address such an incident would be part of their school bullying response. So that would be a local determination depending on the facts of the issue and the school district who would be responding.
Further follow-up, Mr. DePell, and then we are going to have to cut off discussion here and go to closing remarks. We are laying the bill over, but so there is time for further conversation, both with the department and with the author, Representative Jordan. Mr. DePell.
Chair Hill, thank you. Just one really quick follow-up. I'm trying to be real quick for us here. So there's no conformity, and so that means that we will be allowing biological males to compete against biological females, potentially taking away everything that they've worked so hard for in those sports. That's what I'm hearing. And then, and correct me if I'm wrong, and then second to that, if an individual holds to those biological realities that I framed earlier, potentially they could be called a bully just for holding to scientific and biological reality.
Ms. Arriola.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think I would give different answers than what I just stated.
Thank you, Representative DePell.
Thank you, Chair Hill.
We'll go now to Representative Jordan for closing remarks, please.
Did Chair Bennett have? Okay, we're great. We're still working on the bill. It's the MDE policy bill. I'm sure it'll come back in a different form later on. Please direct questions to MDE and myself. And with that, I renew my motion to wait over House File 3730 as amended for consideration at a later date.
Thank you. This meeting is now adjourned.